excuse me. Could I have you put this laptop on, please? Thank you very much. As Jeff has said, we have a session this morning which has as its overall theme integration, which is a pretty broad theme. And I will introduce our speakers individually as they come up. What I did want to do is to take just a minute to cover one other thing. Many of you know that I am chair of the Technical Architecture Group at the W3C, which is in some sense the Technical Steering Committee, or you could view it as the senior technical body responsible for the web. And the reason I'm mentioning that here, as I believe Ian mentioned to those of you who are in the advisory committee, five of our nine members are chosen by election, and this year three of those seats are up for re-election. And having you choose the best possible candidates is probably the most important determinant of our success, and frankly, of what we can work on well. I will sometimes have people come to me and say the tag should work on security. And my first answer is, without reference to the particular people that we have on today, it's always the case that my first response has to be, do we have security experts on the tag? So I would like you to ask you to think very hard and to look for good candidates. I'll briefly say, what do we need in candidates? It varies a bit. Obviously, an ability to think at an architectural level about building systems, but at the same time, to connect that to the real-world challenges of the people that write the specs and deploy things on the web. I mean, there's clearly a natural tension. Our job is to work at a higher level that integrates things, but at the same time, we're very often criticized correctly if we can't do that in a way that solves a real problem for real people. We obviously also need people that work well together, and we need sometimes people who write well, so that's all stuff to consider. I also wanted to tell you that we do have three incumbents, and it's my understanding that at least two of them will not be running. Not particularly, as I understand it, because they're upset about anything, but because they have other things to do with their lives. But that makes it particularly important, and it's one of the reasons that I'm taking time here, that we have a good slate of strong candidates. In addition to me, we have probably more than half the current TAG members and one or two former TAG members. If you are interested in running, or if anybody you know is interested in running, I encourage you to speak to as many of them as possible. Become familiar with the TAG's public mailing list and the TAG's writings, because that'll give you a sense of what we do. Finally, one of our incumbents, T.V. Rahman, particularly asked me to announce that he is among the incumbents who will not be running. He's sitting right here, and if you want to talk to him about his feelings about the TAG and its future, I think you'll find that he's a strong supporter of helping us to find a good slate of candidates. So without further ado, let me switch to the official agenda for our day. We have four speakers. For various reasons, we are probably going to juggle the order a little bit, and I'll explain why later. But our first speaker is indeed Jenny Tennyson. And the reason we scheduled this talk is that it's no secret that the W3C has made a very significant investment for a very long time in the collection of technologies known as the Semantic Web. And those technologies have had increasing success in industry and in government and in a variety of other settings. And yet there is a sense that when we look at the technologies we know that have taken off the fastest, such as the original web, the semantic web has not quite been able to reach that level of sort of self-sustaining acceleration. And so we invited Jenny to come precisely because she is someone who is not only expert in the semantic web, but who has a long history with other related integration technologies. I first knew of Jenny when we were working on various XML specifications, and there was this Jenny person who would send mail, and it was always the most insightful, to the point, helpful mail. And then I gradually discovered that all the people whom I considered the smartest, most tasteful people in our community would always look to her as one of the people that they looked up to. So I thought she would be an excellent person to talk to us about what, in fact, it might take to help the semantic web succeed even better. So, Jenny.
Thank you for that very kind introduction. Right. So one of my roles is that I am the linked data advisor on data.gov.uk, but I should say that I'm not a semantic web evangelist. Like a lot of people, as Noah mentioned, I made the decision about 12 years ago that semantic web was actually all a pipe dream and chose to focus on XML instead. In terms of my role within the UK government linked data effort, I view my role as making sure that we're not just using linked data and semantic web technologies just because Tim Berners-Lee says so, but I want to make sure that we're giving RDF a fighting chance. I want to see if it can be made appealing and useful inside and outside government. I was given the title for this talk, Can We Reach Escape Velocity? I don't particularly care if RDF or the semantic web reaches escape velocity. What I do care about is making data usable, and I do care about making sure that we can have distributed data publication across large and diverse organizations like government, which is a bit like the wider web, but with lots more committees. So this talk is going to have three parts. First of all, I'm going to describe what I see as the potential of the web of data and why I'm interested in it. Then I'm going to describe what I see as the hurdles for RDF being used within it. And then I'm going to try and explore where the community and W3C in particular should be focusing its efforts. So to summarize all that, basically I've taken this as an excuse to have a bit of a rant and say some things that I wouldn't normally say to people's faces. So first of all, I'm going to talk about the potential of the web of data. So the world is very, very different from about 10 years ago when I discounted RDF as being a pipe dream. Open data now is really exploding. You have APIs on websites. There's a big thrust towards the publication of open data, particularly in government where I work. There are visualization blogs, data blogs, there's the Strata conference coming up. There's a big buzz around data. There's a drive to support reuse of data, lots of apps and widgets that you can put into your web pages, lots of visualization tools that you can use, all taking advantage of funky new HTML5 goodness that we're going to spend the rest of the day talking about. But many of these visualizations are a lot like pre-web documents. They're rudimentary views with no chance to go deeper into the data. And I think that we're heading towards a world where we're going to want to support those deeper interactions with data, going to want to enable people to explore it, to slice it, to visualize it in different ways, find out more about the things that it refers to. So data that you can click on, which is a Stuart Williams phrase, which I really like, data you can click on can be as revolutionary as documents that you can click on. But there are some challenges with this kind of vision of the web of data. The first challenge is just because you can get hold of some data does not mean that you can understand that data. And that's particularly true with government data. This example is some UK crime statistics, and it's been published as Excel because CSV just cannot express all of the things that the author of this wanted to express. You can see they're using all sorts of different fonts and things in order to give it some kind of structure and some kind of meaning that as a human we can kind of infer from how it appears. But what do these rows, as a computer, what do these rows actually relate to? What's the definition of an acquaintance? What are the units that these things are measured in? What do any codes in the spreadsheet mean? Only the publisher really knows the answers to that. And what we often find with open government data is that the data is available, but the explanations for how you interpret that data are hidden somewhere completely separate, totally different documents, usually in non-machine readable forms. So there's no way of finding out what it actually means. The second challenge is that we often want to delve deeper into this data. Where is this particular crime on one of these rows, where is that defined in legislation? What areas report the greatest levels? How have those levels changed over time with changes in policy? And for that, then you need some explicit links within the data itself, or you need to have a kind of implicit set of data that you can find about those things that you can discover through search, in the same way as we discover documents through search now. And what we want to head towards in order to get this deeper interaction with data is to combine these sources that you find into new visualizations. So RDF is a really good approach to tackle these challenges. The only real revolution in RDF, but the key one, is that it uses URIs to name things, including the properties and classes that are used to describe the data. So identifying things with URIs does two really useful things. First of all, it disambiguates. So we've got a global identifier scheme. And that means that you can bring data together and create mashups that are beyond just a Google map with some pointers on it. The other thing with the URI is obviously you can visit that URI and find out extra information by going there, get extra explanation, get extra context. And if you're buying into RDF, then you get this basic entity attribute value model that enables you to combine the data that you already have with that extra data without any kind of upfront agreement about terms or any end user jiggery pokery to try and match things up. The other thing is that information that is named through URIs can be referenced rather than copied. An example of this is the BBC's use of Wikipedia and Music Brains and other sources of information that it just pulls into the web pages that it actually presents. And there are huge opportunities within government for using this like reference rather than copy model, because government really just excels at having five different copies of the same code list managed by different people and always getting out of date. So identifying things with URIs, I think, is increasingly natural to normal web developers. But using this principle for real-world things like schools or pillars or abstract things like classes and properties is less so, but still plausible that web developers could get that. So why is it that RDF isn't being used? Let's have a look at, well, majorly. Let's have a look and see what developers say. So I was really delighted when I saw this on the Guardian data blog, which is a newspaper in the UK, has a data blog where they put up loads of data from the UK, because it really made my point for me, straight from the horse's mouth. It is not great fun learning to develop with the semantic web today. So for the next three slides, I'm going to try and put ourselves in developers' shoes and see why not. So when developers start learning about the semantic web, then this is the picture that they see. They see this stack of complex technologies. It even looks as though it's going to fall over on you. And they get introduced to the ugliest syntax first, RDF, XML. And they're led to believe that in order to publish a vocabulary, they have to use OWL, which is just mind-blowing. And then they assume that in order to provide access to information, that they have to run a triple store, which has a SPARKLE endpoint so that people can query over it. None of which is really true, but that is what people assume when they first come to learn about RDF. On the next couple of slides, I'm going to explore this in a bit more depth from two standpoints. First of all, from the standpoint of a consumer of data, and secondly, from a standpoint of a publisher of data who's trying to get data out there. So first of all, if you're consuming some of this data, is it fun and attractive to use RDF and semantic web technologies? If you compare it with JSON, right? If you bring some JSON into your code, then there's a very, very easy map onto object structures. You can immediately use that data within the programming language of your choice. There are parsers on every platform, extremely easy to use. Even with XML, there are standard APIs for accessing data within XML. There are parsers on every platform. And there are simple path languages that you can use, like XPath or CSS, that you can use over XML very easily. The RDF situation is extremely different. First of all, we have multiple syntaxes. For triples, we have, so basic RDF, we have RDF XML, N triples, turtle, N3, tricks, RDFA, RDFJSON, RDFJ, and a bunch of others as well, okay? For quads, then there's NQuads, there's trig, and a bunch of others as well. And then for Sparkle results, there are some more formats. So it's really hard to know as a publisher what to target and as a consumer what you should program your application to expect. There's no standard API for mapping RDF structures into objects so that people can use them within their code and access them easily within their code. There's no path language. So Sparkle is as close as you can get to some kind of standard querying over RDF, but this is just another language for developers to learn and not a particularly approachable one at that. So no, as a consumer of data, it is not fun and attractive to use RDF and Semantic Web. From the standpoint of somebody trying to publish their data, is it painless? Is it unlikely to go wrong? So first of all, library support for creating the formats that I listed is lacking for exactly the same reason as parsing them is hard. So generally, if you're generating some RDF from a relational database or from an object structure, or from an XML structure, you're generating that using technology is often it's equivalent to using string concatenation to creating XML. You're not serializing a graph, you're just doing a map into RDF XML or doing string concatenation kind of thing. So there's a vast array of formats and it's not clear which ones are useful to target and it's hard to generate them. Also, the dream of embedding RDF into HTML is actually often a nightmare. RDFA is very, very difficult to get right, and I say that as somebody who's written two parsers for RDFA and websites that generate RDFA. Microdata, the new proposal, is quite verbose, and it doesn't cover all the cases that we need within RDF. And if you want to see an example, then have a look at Facebook's use of RDFA, which shows the kind of compromises that are being made in the real world in order to use that, using a single vocabulary, fudging between literals and resources, and having a snickable bit at the head of a document rather than embedding it in the content. Also, there's a whole level of infrastructure around RDF publishing that makes it even more complex. All the decisions around hash and slash URIs, the use of redirections, and the publication of vocabularies. So publication is not painless. And if you get it wrong, you're very likely to get some negative feedback. So I've covered the issues. Now I'm going to start trying to look at what we should do. So developers aren't going to be persuaded just by argument to adopt RDF. RDF needs to meet developers where they are now. It needs to fit with the object-oriented programming model that developers use typically. We need tools and APIs that are easy and fun to use and slot into the way that developers are naturally working. And we need easy-to-follow recipes that avoid too much thought on their behalf. We need to focus on the benefits that developers can bring to their end users. So for data consumers, that benefit of being able to click into some data to find out more about it, or to easily incorporate data from other places into a visualization, or being able to reach behind a visualization to the source of some data. For publishers, we need to make the argument that that using RDF automatically increases the utility and the value of their data because it's easier to combine with other data. And it gives them the ability to control the context that people see within their data, which means that they don't have so much of an excuse for misinterpretation. This is a very good argument to use within government. And they have the ability to enhance what they're publishing with data from elsewhere. The good news here is that the network effect is very, very strong with linked data. The more people that use it, the easier it is to use, and the more powerful its use becomes. And we now have a state where we have some core hubs of URIs that other people can link to, so you don't have to invent your own URIs for everything, which was the case for a long time. Like there's DBpedia, Music Brains, the BBC, UK government, there's a whole bunch of things that you can use. And there's some core vocabularies that publishers can use, so you're not having to invent your own vocabularies all the time. So stuff like FIRE for Dublin Core, SCOS, and so on and so on. So all of this reduces the need for invention, which lowers the barrier to, and it provides a focus for tools, for tool support. And I think that in government and also in commerce, there's starting to be a, everyone else is doing it, let me get on the bandwagon buzz. That's not the case in every area, and it's just starting, but I think that there is that. There are some promising developments currently going on that are along these lines. So the linked data movement, which I've kind of mentioned, focuses on those useful core technologies, not the huge stack. And they're creating lots of guides and best practices and those kinds of documentation to help people in. But what we really need is for the consumption of the data to drive the publication patterns. We need to be saying to publishers, if you do it like this, it makes my job easier to consume it. And developers then are given the power to make educated choices about how they publish their data. And that linked data movement has had a very strong influence on the RDF Next Steps workshop. So there's some promise about what RDF 1.1 will look like around those ideas. on the consumption side of things, there's a generic RDF API embedded within the RDFA API. And there are property paths within Sparkle 1.1, which so that could have a potential for being a syntax for paths through data, the kind of path language that I was talking about. But what we need here as an API is something that looks like jQuery or Nokogiri or Apricot or something like that, something that's accessible and fun and easy to use, not something like XML's DOM. And it needs to be usable in contexts other than in the browser, because we're using RDF in other contexts as well. On the publication of data, there's some promising work going on the mapping of relational structures into RDF. But what my concern is are these going to be picked up and actually used within the Ruby on Rails community or the Django community or and so on, okay, by the people that actually want to use it, might want to use it. So this is my last slide. I've tried to focus in this talk on meeting the challenges of this gradually blossoming web of data. I do think that linked data is a really powerful approach here, but it's currently being avoided, I think, mostly due to some stigma and misperception about what RDF is, views that were formed years ago, and exacerbated by the focus in semantic web on logic and reasoning, which, in terms of publishing data, are just currently irrelevant. And there's just a lack of fun and easy-to-use implementations for people who want to get into it. So what role can W3C play? I've thought long and hard since I was given this talk about this. And it's very hard to answer, because I think that the biggest gaps are actually in implementations, and that's not something W3C does. However, W3C blessing can help implementers to make decisions about what they support, which formats to support, which APIs to implement. And given that there's this vast array of choices within the RDF world, then that blessing can be a really vital thing. So another thing is supporting the profiling of RDF to just profile down to the bits that are currently understood to be the relevant parts, and primers on what those useful core technologies are. I think the W3C could also provide a home for some of the community standards that have built up within within linked data and RDF, because it's hard to trust vocabularies that you know are maintained by a single person or are run on university domains. It's hard to reuse those, especially from a government context. Also, W3C could extend the services that help developers get started: syntax checking, validation against known vocabularies, visualization of what you've actually produced and things. And more dramatically, W3C could just sideline the whole semantic web term and focus instead on web of data, of which linked data would be a part. So my biggest concern is that, like every community, the linked data community is too insular and maybe deaf to some of the wider developer concerns. This is just a common human pattern that we fall into these self-reinforcing groups. And once you've adapted into the group, it's very hard to see the gaps that are very apparent when you're an outsider. But we only grow if we listen and we change. So W3C has a wide range of members, and it's you, not Semantic Web Community, you are the people to listen to on this. So if you've avoided RDF for the last 10 years, I think it's time to look again and see whether there are some maps to what you want to do and to help to make the web of data blossom into something that's beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Jenny. We actually have 10 or 15 minutes for questions if people care to discuss this topic, which is an important one. If you'd come up to the microphone if you have questions or comments. Doug?
Doug Shepherds, W3C. Hi, Jenny.
Hi.
Great talk.
Thank you.
So do you think that there's value in, okay, so I've tried using SimWeb technologies, as you know, with SVG, I've been mixing RDFA and microdata, and I've tried the works. And one thing I keep bumping up against is not finding the right ontology to solve the problem I'm trying to solve. And I've seen that there have been some efforts to try to consolidate ontologies and create ontology access libraries, but what I personally want as a developer is the ability to tell them what I'm looking for in general rough terms, sort of tell them the domain of knowledge I'm looking for. Am I trying to talk about publishing? Am I trying to talk about animal taxonomy? Am I trying to talk about whatever? And tell them, and have them tell me, have some, you know, site tell me, here are a bunch of related ontologies, here are a bunch of related things that you might look further in, because it's impossible for me to dig into all the different possibly interlinked, possibly made irrelevant or redundant ontologies. Do you think that there's value in W3C making some sort of effort in unifying ontologies or helping people come together on ontologies?
So, is this on? I do think that there's legs to that, and it's something that within the government linked data interest group and that area that we're thinking of doing, particularly for to help recommend to governments which ontologies are good to use, and to help and to try and list some of the criteria that you can use in order to assess whether an ontology is going to be good to use or a vocabulary is going to be good to use. I think it's quite hard to, as you say, to understand the context of a particular vocabulary when you just search for it or on one of these sites that you were talking about, because it's so much about community and acceptance and who else is using it, right? And what tools are available for it, and how is it maintained? And actually, you know, if it was made 5 years ago, is that and hasn't been adjusted since, is that a good sign or a bad sign? You just don't know. So I think that means that you need to have curated lists rather than searchable lists. And I think that's a role that W3C could
could play.
Jeff?
Hey, Jenny, great talk.
Thank you.
Great presentation, great graphics.
Thank you.
And very well balanced. Thank you for that. So you talked about insularity of W3C in the design of the semantic web technology and so forth, which I think is a fair comment. And I think you talked through, you know, what do we do about that? A lot of the problems are in implementation, also a fair comment, and actually something that we struggle with a lot internally because we see it a lot the same way. You know, to really do something, it's someone else that needs to do it. And so I was wondering if you could recommend one very specific, tangible thing that we could do tomorrow that would break some of the insularity. So I think, you know, in trying to get this topic on the table today, that's a step. And I'm also concerned that after you've given your very thoughtful input, you know, we'll all go back and say, okay, that was thoughtful. Now let's just keep being insular. So how do we change that? How do we break that?
That's a good question. And I did, on a previous set of these slides, have that as a point, that developers won't get involved in something that they don't care about, right? So, because, like, why would they? The only time that developers or people outside the group would get involved is when you start reaching out and trying to affect other things. So actually, you know, people started looking at RDFA when it was affecting HTML and encroaching on that space. So, you know, as a subversive thing, one thing to do is to start trying to affect other places, to get developers to see that there is that technology there, and to object against it, and to then listen to those objections. I found that the best way of working out what is wrong with the technology is to try to teach people about it, because you find the places where it's hard that way, where people struggle. And so creating primers actually helps you to understand where people are going to struggle, if you can get a community to actually assess them. So I'm sorry, I don't think anybody has any answers to that, to be honest.
Okay, well, if we have no one else at the microphone, I think I'll ask a question, and then we'll decide whether to keep going or go to Tim. You've made very clear that ease of use is a big challenge, and you've spoken about implementations, which I suspect covers both runtime implementations, but especially tooling and related sorts of developer aids. So I wanted to ask you if you've given any thought, and this may be to steps that the W3C itself can't take, but maybe can help other people to take. If you could imagine the most helpful developments relating, let me try it this way. There are sort of two threads in how people take complex technologies and make them easy to use. One is to just try to make them simpler, sort of with a goal that programmers using Emacs can use them directly. The other thread is to say that the sort of underlying technology may remain complex, but we will have tools like Visual Studio, like Eclipse, that will allow, on good days, 90% of the developers to do 90% of what they need to do with drag and drop. Do you have a sense of that balance? Is this an area where the W3C needs to come up with simpler specs, or where the tooling community needs to wrap them in things that are easier to use?
Okay. My general stand, my general principle when it comes to ease of use of things is, if you have to go to a tool in order to make it easy to use, then the specs are too complex. That's my general stand on that question. So, there you are.
Okay, thank you, Jenny. Oh, one more question. Roger, Tim, you can, I think, start coming up anyway, but Roger, go ahead.
Roger Cutler, Chevron. You said somewhere in your talk, you just casually said that the W3C doesn't do things like implementation. Well, suppose you were to sort of cancel that out and say that just for the moment, for the sake of argument, that the W3C might do something in the way of implementation because there's no place else that's going to get done. What if you sort of took that as a states as a argument point or starting point? What then could the W3C? I have some ideas along those lines, but what do you think the W3C could do along the lines of implementation or aiding implementation? If you sort of assume, no, maybe the W3C does do that kind of thing. Well, then what would it do?
So I think that creating in some target language, a really, really good RDF parser and API that was well packaged, that was easy to install, that was brain dead simple to use would be the technology that I would go for, but that was actually finished and completed and had some professional quality to it. That was what I'd say.
Okay, thank you, Jenny.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Could you switch laptops here briefly? Oh, great, thank you. Our next scheduled speaker is Alexei Melnikov, but we are going to move that to the end of the session. Basically, what happened is that Alexei didn't make his travel connections last night, and as far as I know, is not here yet. There is a small hope that he will arrive by the end of the session, which is why we're moving things. If he doesn't come, then we have Thomas Russler, who is very familiar with the material, and he will present it for Alexei. So, with that explanation, our next talk is by Tim, and it is to discuss an effort that he and the TAG